yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a-screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Okay, today's show, we're going to continue on this theme, as I promised, of a review of the global economy at year end. We've begun this process of review. We will continue here today and in the subsequent weeks, and finish with in early 2015 with a view of the U.S. economy. Okay, we've been talking a lot about emerging markets, and then we've talked about the impact of the global oil crash, oil price crash, which is still going on. Today we want to talk in relation to that. What's going on in the Russian and Ukraine economies, as well as the recent event last week of the announcement in Japan of a whole new phase in their policies called Abenomics. You know, Abe, who is the Shinzo Abe, the prime minister in Japan, recently announced what we will call Abenomics 2.0. 1.0 has been in effect for a couple years now, and we started discussing that briefly, but we will continue in the latter half of the show talking about this announcement and what it means in Japan. But first, let's go back and look at the other side of the world. We want to talk about what's going on globally, and in particular with Russia and the oil price collapse and the Ukraine, and its impact, of course, on Western Europe as well, on the EU. And this even plays into the recent U.S. Federal Reserve Central Bank, U.S. Fed announcements of a few days ago, and the reboom in the U.S. stock market. Every time we have an announcement that ensures, the Federal Reserve ensures that the money, free money spigot's going to continue, there goes the stock markets. So what we got in the U.S. here, and in particularly in the financial market, stock markets, is this ping-pong effect between the collapse in the rest of the global economy, slowing in the global economy going on across the board, and the oil price shock. And that has a downward effect on stocks and financial markets in the U.S. But then offsetting that is this repeated free money spigot that the Fed ensures. And when the Fed makes an announcement that says, oh, the free money is going to continue, well, boom, there goes the stock market back up. And when we have more bad news about global oil prices falling everywhere, and the rest of the global economy slowing everywhere, then the market goes down. So we're going up and down, up and down. The Dow is between 17,000 and 18,000, and it drops on the bad news to about 17. And then there's good news, and in come the big institutional capitalist investors, and they pump it back up to 18, and then it goes back down to 17. There's so much money, trillions of dollars on the sidelines, particularly in these big shadow banks and big global capitalist investors. Whenever they see a 5% dip in the Dow, they jump back in with big money, drive it up, speculate, drive up the prices, make a killing, and then let the thing drift back down again to about 17. So we've been seeing this up and down, 17 to 18,000 on the Dow. And it's really a consequence of what's happening in the real economy globally being offset what's happening in the phony economy in the U.S., in which the Federal Reserve keeps pumping all this free money or ensuring that the free money will continue in the U.S. So that's a important current dynamic going on. The real world slowing due to real reasons, and then the U.S. money bags, making sure that their stock and bond markets are still recovering. And we go back and forth, back and forth. And that may go on for some time now. Okay, let's look back at the central theme of continuing global major trends. One, first major trend, slowdown in emerging markets, and that includes China. I mean, real slowdown. The real economies are slowing down globally everywhere. China is sort of hinting it will admit very soon that it won't hit a 7% annual GDP growth rate. Well, independent researchers have for some time saying it will not, and in fact it still isn't even at 7%. Most say it's somewhere between 6 and 7. Well, China is admitting, about to admit that yes, well, okay, it's not 7, it may be something less. They always overestimate their growth rate. At one point, you know, during a high mark a couple years ago, China was growing at 12-13%. And now, of course, it's barely half that. And that China slowdown is very important because if China slows down economically, it stops importing all kinds of commodities that it needs to keep its manufacturing economy going, commodities being all kinds of metals and natural resources and food commodities, you know, soy and wheat and so forth that it imports, but also metals that it imports heavily, you know, and its trading, key trading partners, you know, South Africa for various natural resources, Brazil for natural resources, etc., all around the world. A lot of this these commodities are bought by China, and when China slows down its economy, its demand for these economies, these commodities slows down, and thus the exports and the production in those other emerging markets also slow down. So the slowdown in emerging markets is driven in part by what's going on in China in terms of slowing down, but the slowdown in emerging markets also being driven by the Federal Reserve's policy regarding interest rates and money. When the Federal Reserve discontinues quantitative easing and indicates it may be raising rates, investors in these emerging markets say it's time to get out of our currencies and get into the dollar because the dollars are going to start rising. If the U.S. raises interest rates, the dollar will rise, and even the talk of raising interest rates has driven up the U.S. dollar. And what happens, you know, all that funding and capital, money capital that's flowed out into the emerging markets since 2009 from the U.S. and the West starts coming back. No one wants to hold foreign currencies, investors I'm talking about, wants to hold foreign currencies when their value is declining. What they do is sell those currencies and convert it to dollars whose value is rising. You see, so the rising dollar is very important. For whatever the cause is behind it, if the dollar rises, investors don't want to take a loss holding foreign currency, so they cash out those currencies, cash out those investments, you know, in Argentina, Brazil, wherever, convert it back to dollars, and of course, that cash out drives the value of those foreign currencies down even further and drives the value of the dollar up even more. Well, that's going on as the Fed discontinues its quantitative easing for last year and a half. Now it's discontinued. That has put pressure on currencies, both rising dollar and corresponding falling foreign exchange currencies of these other countries. So that's an important development. Why? Because when the currencies decline and investors cash out, it leads to capital flight out of these emerging markets. Oh, well, capital flowing out is no longer invested, so the real economy slowed down in these emerging markets. And if the real economy is slowing down, their financial markets, their stock markets, begin to decline. In order to prevent the flowing out of capital, these countries raise their interest rates, their domestic interest rates, raising their domestic interest rates in order to protect their currency, of course, has the effect of slowing their economies even more. So they get caught in this terrible cycle. And this cycle has been growing slowly but steadily for 18 months now, all because of talk of the Fed of raising interest rates. In anticipation, investors want to get out before it actually happens, and because of slowing exports of commodities to China and elsewhere in these emerging markets. So emerging markets are the focal point of the global slowdown, but China, being part of emerging markets, sort of a special case, but nonetheless, is also slowing down. Why is China slowing down? Well, we'll have a show on that in the next couple of weeks, but a large part of it is China trying to deal with its shadow banks, trying to tame the shadow banking system, which has caused bubbles in its currency and its housing market and its local government lending market. And when it tries to deal with these shadow banks, it slows down its economy. So financial speculation lays ultimately behind much of the slowdown in China. And, of course, financial speculation is what we talk about when we're referring to investors selling foreign currencies and converting to dollars and so forth, trying to make a capital gains out of the growth in the rise in the value of the dollar. So finance capital, global finance capital, is behind a lot of the disruption going on. And, of course, finance capital is involved with this global oil price collapse. Yes, oil is not just a physical commodity. It is also a financial security and an instrument, at least since the 90s, when trading in oil commodity futures has become very important. And the thing about these financial securities, when one collapses too far, too fast, it has a negative psychological effect on related currencies and related financial securities. So there's this psychological contagion kind of effect that goes on with all financial instruments, because the same people who are trading one are trading all the others. This is the global financial elite. That financial contagion effect is very important. Hard to put your finger on, but it's very important in the global economy here. So slowdown in emerging markets, including China, one of the big trends, important long-term real trends, the oil price collapse, which began in earnest last June, is another major factor that's overlaid upon this first force of the slowing in the emerging markets, both because of China slowing and because of the U.S. and central banks and the advanced economies' policies of raising rates to, particularly the U.S., to draw capital back. Those two forces are the two most important forces at play now in the global economy. We talked about the oil price collapse a little last time. The thing to remember about the oil price collapse is that it, too, has an important influence on rising value of the dollar. There's this strong relationship between declining oil prices globally and rising U.S. dollar. It's just the same parallel to the Fed policy shift, which causes a rise in the U.S. dollar. And remember, whatever causes a rise in the U.S. dollar causes a corresponding decline in other foreign currencies. So the Fed, talking over the last year or so, has caused the dollar to rise and the other currencies to fall with the effects I described. Well, the collapsing oil price has the same effect as this Fed policy shift. It, too, drives up the value of the U.S. dollar, drives down other foreign currencies, with all the other consequences of capital flight and real investment decline and financial market decline and domestic interest rate increases and economic slowdown in these other countries, emerging market countries. Now we are just in pretty much the first phase of the oil price collapse since June up until the present, where we see that those countries that produce crude oil, their economies, their currencies are being really whacked the hardest. But it's beginning to spill over to other commodity exporting countries as well. Think of this oil price collapse as an overlay negative effect on top of the already slowing effects in emerging markets in China and so forth that's already happening. Think about this description, these two things, and the stagnation in the European economy and actually slow drift into recession in Europe. Overlay that on Japan's collapse of its economy now, and we'll talk about that shortly later. So we have this picture outside the U.S. of Japan now in a recession, a deep recession again, Europe slipping into recession, and now the recessionary effects are not just in the southern periphery of Europe, but it's in the core economies of France and Germany going on. Two very weak situations there in Europe. Weak situation in Japan. Europe is about a $12, $13 trillion GDP. Japan is about a $5, $6 trillion GDP. That's $20 trillion in GDP. What do we got in China? About $9, $10 trillion. So that's $30 trillion of global GDP that is clearly slowing with no signs of abatement. And then we got the $17 trillion U.S. economy, which everyone says, oh, it's on the way up, it's on the way up. Well, we'll talk about that more. Nonetheless, $17 trillion, even if it is true, which it partly is not, you've got 30 to 40 trillion in the rest of the global economy slowing down. Can the U.S. continue to grow even when it falsifies its GDP and so forth? Even when much of that GDP growth is industrial production, which is related to the oil shale energy boom, which will slow now. Can the U.S. continue to grow when the rest of the world economy, 40 trillion of it, is slowing down? Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? And we'll keep coming back to that in future discussions and watching that closely. But once again, to get back to where we left off, we're just in the first phase of this decline in global oil prices. How much have they declined? Well, they were at the beginning of the year, $115 a barrel. What are they now? Well, they're somewhere around in the high 50s. If you use the two benchmarks, which is the West Texas Intermediate, it's just under $60. And if you use the North Sea Brent crude, it's about the same, maybe 61, 62. Okay, and they've been dropping down. They dropped as far as 55 and so forth. They seem to be hovering there just below 60. Now, the problem is if that oil price drops even further, what you're going to get are significant defaults in businesses that are related to particularly to oil. And that includes the shale gas and shale oil extraction companies in the U.S. Right now, the first phase here is those countries that are in economies that are clearly related to oil, that most of their commodity exports are oil, most of their government revenues come from oil, they're hurting the most. And therefore, their currencies are collapsing the most. Let's take Russia, obviously, but we can also talk about Venezuela, Nigeria, even Norway, and soon Canada. These are all countries and economies heavily dependent on oil energy exports. Well, Russia is being whacked the most right now. because it appears to be the most dependent on oil exports. And as oil prices fall by more than 50%, you know, that has a big negative effect on Russia's currency. Russia's currency has declined about the same, about 40 to 50% here since June. You see, all of these effects are on these currencies have been exacerbated in the last 6 months since June because of the falling oil prices. You know, the problems economically in Russia are not primarily the sanctions from the West, which had been pretty much ineffective, but it's the oil price collapse that's occurring and driving Russia, and we'll talk about its economy a little bit more shortly, into a recession. But Venezuela has the same problem. Big decline in oil prices have resulted in a bigger, even bigger decline in its currency. Nigeria, another big oil-dependent exporting country, its currency, the Naira, has collapsed. Well, not as much as Venezuela's Russia, but significantly because they've been devaluing their currency all along, Nigeria. But even countries like Norway, you know, they're solid economy, but you know, their currency has declined. Their currency, the krona, has declined 17-18%. And Canada will soon have the similar problem. So we have this situation of the first phase of the oil price collapse really impacting those countries that really are dependent on oil exports. But the second phase is now emerging. The second phase is there's this relationship between oil as a commodity and other commodities, other kinds of commodities, you know, metals and grains and so forth. And as the financial security of oil commodity futures declines, so do the futures securities options for other kinds of commodities decline. And that spills over to their real economy as well. Look at Indonesia, Turkey, Mexico, Argentina. All of their currencies are now also beginning to fall. And falling, of course, as a consequence of the decline in ultimately of oil and the currencies in these other countries. So we have the spillover effect now beginning to hit other emerging markets in terms of the influence of the oil price collapse, because it's tied to other kinds of commodities. And the financial securities based upon oil are tied to financial securities in the other commodities. Investors see one and declining, and they want to get out before the others decline too much. So that's that psychological effect that plays such a big role in investor moves and confidence, particularly investment in financial securities. All right. Now, it has an impact on other credit markets. The big credit market that's at risk here is the junk bond market, particularly in the U.S. Junk bonds are basically riskier bonds that companies issue. They're not as solid, and the companies and they have to pay a greater interest rate to borrowers who buy their bonds. And junk bonds are at risk. We've had this tremendous boom in the junk bond market in the last several years as investors have gone after higher and higher riskier securities, junk bonds being more riskier than investment-grade corporate bonds. And what you see is this junk bond market under risk right now, particularly in the U.S., where at least 15-20% of all the junk bonds are have been issued by shale producers, you know, drillers and pipelines and so forth. So if this market for oil, the price declines, what this means is these companies in the shale gas oil space have less income to service these very expensive bonds they've issued. Well, they can't pay off the bonds. perhaps. If their revenue, if the price of oil drops too far and their revenue drops too far, they don't have the cash flow to pay these bonds. And if they don't pay a bond, they default. If they start defaulting on bonds, that has this psychological effect on other investors who then start dumping these bonds. And because financial instruments are connected to each other, it could have a spillover effect on not only the entire junk bond market in the U.S., but it could have a spillover effect to other securities as well. Certainly regional U.S. banks that issue a lot of these junk bonds will be impacted as well. But it could spill over to other corporate bonds. The problem with these junk bonds and corporate bonds right now is evident in the rapidly rising cost of insurance on these bonds. Not only credit default swaps, but what's called credit indexes and other financial instruments, derivatives, are linked to these junk bonds. So if the junk bonds in shale and gas decline, as I said, it could spread to the rest of the junk bond market, and the rest of that junk bond market could spread to other corporate bonds and other securities related. And the regional banks who are holding these. In other words, financial asset price collapse has this tendency to contagion because they're all linked and because the investors holding them have these psychological proclivities here, and they jump out of things even when they aren't in trouble yet in order to capture their profits and not experience losses. And we don't know exactly what the effects are of these derivatives linked to junk bonds. We don't know because the trading is not transparent. It's secretive. It's opaque. We don't know the connections yet. Just recall what happened in 2008 when the insurance company AIG was holding all these credit default swaps, i.e. derivatives, on Lehman Brothers and so forth. That was a big surprise. No one knew that AIG had hundreds of billions of contracts here on the credit default swaps on Lehman. Lehman Brothers, the investment bank that collapsed. Well, look, when the Russian ruble declines by 50%, no one knows what the real connections are between such a decline in banks in Russia and banks in Western Europe and other securities and so forth. No one knows. What we do know is that somebody's buying an awful lot of insurance contracts, both on oil-related bonds and junk bonds and so forth. Somebody's buying a lot. That means somebody's worried out there. And the contagion could occur. You see, in the capitalist economy, when these financial asset prices, whichever asset you're talking about, move too quick, too fast, in whatever direction, right, collapse too far, too fast, such as currencies are now doing, such as oil price, which is a financial security, is now doing, once these things collapse too far, too fast, it destabilizes the whole system. And that's what's exactly happening. Okay, you have to understand that the Fed decision this past week to give this notice on Wednesday gave a notice that, we're not going to raise interest rates for not at least a couple more months, two more months. And then the stock market, went crazy, whoopee, and there goes the price. The stock's up again, the biggest two-day gain since 2011. Oh, the free money is going to continue. Well, why did the Fed do that? Because the Fed knows that if it signaled it was going to raise rates, which it wants to do, if it gave that signal, that would just exacerbate the problem of an already rising dollar because of the oil price collapse. It would have added fuel to the fire of the expectation the dollar will rise. And, of course, if the dollar rises, other currencies collapse with all those effects I talked about. So that's what's behind the Fed this past week holding off. And when the stock markets, which are shadow bankers, institutionals, and so forth. You know, they're the big buyers and sellers of stocks. When they saw this, okay, the Fed's going to keep the free money spigot going. You know, it's not going to add fuel to the oil deflation collapse. In fact, the Fed announcement is really a way of offsetting that oil deflation effect, negative impact on stock markets. You know, once they saw that, they said, whoopee, here we go, let's go back in, right? Let's go back in. You know, it's at high 16,000 of the Dow. Let's go buy it back up. And that's exactly what they did. So the Fed blinked and retreated on its interest rate increase suggestions of recent months, and the free money spigot is there. But fundamentally, the big problems in the global economy have not changed, and that is the emerging markets are slowing, China is slowing, oil prices are falling and will continue to fall, I predict somewhere in the $40 to $50 range, and we have a deep crisis in these oil-exporting economies like Russia, Venezuela, Nigeria, and so forth. Now, I also said that this deep crisis in Russia and Venezuela and so forth is going to, be exploited politically by the U.S. And, in fact, the U.S. may even be behind this, getting together, at least the neocons in the U.S., getting together with their friends, you know, in Saudi Arabia and saying, you know, okay, our sanctions aren't working on Russia here. Because of the situation in the Ukraine, which we want to take over and rip out of the Russian sphere of influence. You know, sanctions aren't working, so, okay, Saudis, let's get together here and let's use the market as a way of wrecking the Russian economy. And, you know, it's working. It's working. And, of course, the Saudis go along with this, probably even initiated it because, you know, They would like to put pressure on Iran. They want to wreck Iran's economy. And of course, you know, it's also an indication that the Saudis see this whole shale gas oil boom as a long-term existential threat to its income from crude oil. So there's a number of developments going on that probably converged here that led to the Saudis a couple of weeks ago saying, okay, we're not going to try to prop up the price of oil. Let's let it fall. And let's see where it goes in terms of putting pressure on Russia, Iran, and so forth. And the U.S. neocons probably said, oh, that's a good idea. We can put pressure on Russia. And by the way, we'll put pressure even more on Venezuela. Look, they're getting ready to go after Venezuela, no doubt. They're doing, for the past year or so, everything they can to destabilize they, meaning the U.S., and you know, the neocons, turning now to going back to Latin America and Asia, particularly Latin America, and trying to clean up what it considers too much democracy and challenges to its world order here. So they're going after and destabilizing, and we will see in a further intensification of destabilizing Venezuela here economically before they make another move politically on Venezuela. Okay, so you know, fundamentally things have not changed in the real economy, China, emerging markets, global oil, and real impacts, you know, severe impact, pushing economies like Russia and Venezuela into a crisis here. So let's look at the Russian economy a little bit. All right, what do we got here? We got the ruble, its currency, declining more than 50%, although it's recently just stabilized because of counter moves by Russia. Interest rates, you know, the Russian Central Bank raised interest rates from 10 to 17% here. 17%, that's a huge increase. Well, why is that? Because the ruble declining, tendency for cashing out of the ruble and buying, you know, euros and dollars and so forth by Russian investors, and that means capital flight. So what do? You raise your interest rates. The central bank raises interest rates to keep that money attracted and keep it in Russia, okay? And also to bring foreign money now into Russia as well to take advantage of the 17% interest rates. So we got a 17% interest rate, which has the concurrent negative effect of slowing the Russian economy, right? If you're a Russian business or a Russian consumer, you're not going to borrow at 17%. It's just way too high. So it slows down your domestic economy, but it keeps your currency from collapsing and capital from flowing out of the country. But it throws your economy into a recession, and Russia now has crossed that Rubicon, and very definitely it has entered recession, and there will be an even deeper recession in 2015 in Russia. So what the Western sanctions weren't able to achieve, falling global oil prices did. And if anyone thinks that those falling global oil prices have no political objectives behind them, and that the U.S. is not cooperating and encouraging and maybe even directing what Saudi Arabia does, I think you're pretty naive. Okay. So the Western sanctions did not have any effect, but now one sanction will have an effect, and that is denying credit to Russia. Western banks denying credit to Russia. While Russian economy was booming and oil was high, that didn't really have much of an effect. But now when the Russian economy is not booming and credit is in dire need, that sanction will have more an effect on Russia. So collapsing oil prices now clearly throwing Russia, as it is Venezuela and Nigeria and others, into deep recessions. All right, okay. What's another effect? But another effect is going to be on Western Europe. You see, there's blowback. There is feedback here. What will be the effect of Russian recession on Western Europe? Well, it can be fairly significant on an economy in Western Europe that's already very fragile, very weak, and slowly declining in a number of places, including the core, Germany and France. Okay, so what... What are some of the feedback effects on Germany here? Well, Russia purchases a significant amount of German exports, not just directly through Germany, but semi-finished German goods that get bought by Eastern European countries that get exported to Russia as well. Russia purchases these German exports, direct and indirect, and it's a significant amount. So if Russian economy slows down, then the demand for these German exports slows down as well, and therefore the German economy slows down. That's why, you know, this recently, about a week ago, a huge delegation of German businessmen went to Moscow, and they're trying to figure out a way of how they can mitigate this effect. You know, typically the Europeans and the Germans and Eastern Europeans are paying for this U.S. policy of trying to put the screws to the Russian economy over the Ukraine, right? U.S. is not paying much of an economic price for this, but the Europeans are. Okay, so that's one effect. The other is the German and East European economies purchase a significant amount of their natural gas, over half of it, from Russia. So if they're economies are slowing, and they're purchasing less natural gas, it's going to slow Russia even more. And it's going to mean Russia is going to be able to earn less foreign currencies and revenue, will have less to spend on its own economy, and therefore that will slow the Russian economy too. So we have this mutual slowdown effect that's going to happen here. As oil prices decline, and the big effect on Western Europe will be on the Eastern European countries Germany itself, Germany and Austria. Okay, so that's another consequence here of this oil price collapse. The European economic picture, well, slowing, as I said, in the core economies, Germany, France, and Italy. We've got a new political crisis emerging in Greece. The Greek people appear to be fed up with the IMF and with, you know, all of the depression that they've been in for 5-6 years now, at least 5 years. as a result of IMF and EU commission and other bailouts and debt that's been piled on Greece that they can't finance. And finally, we have a new third political party there, Syriza, and it looks like it has a chance of winning. And if it wins, its leaders have said we either renegotiate fundamentally this debt owed to Western Europe, or we're going to get out of the euro. We're going to leave the European Union. Well, no one knows the big negative effect that would make and would have on the rest of the European economy, which is already very weak. So that's coming up. You know, debt renegotiation or debt forgiveness or we're going to leave is an important development there. Elsewhere in Europe, we see this trend, I've talked about it before, towards more austerity, nonetheless, even given its slowdown. And the new forms of austerity, of course, have to do with what's called restructuring of those economies, which means mostly restructuring labor markets, which means lowering wages and eliminating benefits. We see these plans being rolled out in France, labor market reform, they call them, and in Italy right now as we speak. And now Germany is even talking about limiting the right to strike for independent unions here that have been causing its capitalists some concern. Okay, so in the European economic picture, slow down, more crisis in Greece, more confrontation, labor market reforms, and the Ukraine depression. Months ago, I wrote about when the IMF imposed its policies in April of this year that it would lead to a depression in the Ukraine, a la much like Greece. In other words, you know, you're looking depression is a 20% to 30% unemployment and other severe cutbacks in government spending and severe effects on prices and so forth and investment. That's what a depression is. Unlike a recession in Western Europe, there's a depression in the Ukraine. Right? The bailout, initial bailout by the Ukraine, by the IMF and the European Commission, was $17.1 billion in April. I predicted at the time, wrote several articles, you can read them on my blog, jockrasmus.com, that the Ukraine would need $50 billion at least over the next 2 years, not the $17 billion. Okay. It looks like that it's moving in that direction, that it's going to need something like $15 billion because Ukraine is a financial basket case and a mess. The IMF policies have not had any positive effect, in fact, have had a negative effect on Ukraine since April. The Ukrainian currency has crashed more than 70%, the worst in the world. If you look at the $17 billion of the initial bailout, only $4.5 billion of that has actually been dispersed by the IMF to Ukraine. And that has been used, two things. One, to repay past bailouts to the IMF, what it's owed on past loans, to repay interest and principal on debt owed to Western European banks, particularly Italian and Austrian and other banks in the West, and money of the $4.5 billion used by the Ukrainian Central Bank to try to purchase its currency in open markets to try to prevent it from falling, which has failed, and money used by the Central Bank in Ukraine for businesses to fund exports and purchases, okay? That's what the central bank does. You know, it buys up its currency to try to keep it up there, and or it helps provide foreign currency to Ukrainian businesses to buy needed intermediate and resource goods from the West now that they're not buying from Russia. Okay, so it hasn't, this $4.5 billion, also about another $2-3 billion for gas payments to Russia. Back payments that the Ukraine has refused to pay for several years now. So that's where all the money has gone. It hasn't gone to resurrect or re-stimulate the Ukrainian economy. It's gone to investors and debt payments, or to the central bank. Central bank has spent it, but to no effect on the economy. In fact, Ukraine probably now, well, they announced a week or so ago they had about $9 billion in foreign currency reserves to finance exports and imports, but, you know, they probably have close to half of that, which means they got about two weeks left. After that, Ukraine businesses have no currency, and the economy will get even worse. Okay. Now, in the face of this terrible situation, economic situation in the Ukraine, by the way, just to give you some idea here, the IMF, when it bailed out in April, said that, oh, well, there would be a 5% drop in the economy this year, but it will grow 2% in 2015. Well, as things got worse over the summer, the IMF changed its forecast. And twice here in its latest forecast in September was, there'll be a 7.3% drop in the economy this year and a 4.6% drop in 2015. And the World Bank then came out with even a worse forecast, 8%. And this was last September, October. So things have gotten worse, and we're probably looking at an 8 to 10% drop in GDP in the economy here, which was what I had forecast last spring. Not only that it would need $50 billion, but that the economy would drop somewhere between 8 and 15% over the next 18 months, which is exactly right about where it has declined. By the way, that 8% drop in the economy amounts to a $14 billion decline in Ukraine's GDP, which, in other words, the real economy has totally offset that $17 billion, which hasn't been IMF loan, which hasn't been really distributed to the real economy, just the debtors and financiers. So that gives you another sense of how serious the collapse has been in the Ukraine. Now, what's really interesting is a couple of weeks ago, the new government, Poroshenko, the president, and this guy Yatsenyuk, who is the prime minister, formed their cabinet. Yatsenyuk formed his cabinet. And who's in his cabinet? Oh, well, who's in the key positions of finance minister and economics minister? Well, foreigners. Yeah, they appointed foreigners to run their economy. I'm sure the IMF and the U.S. required that. Who are these foreigners? Well, who's running the finance? Who's the finance minister? You know, who's running the financial side, which is the key right now in Ukrainian economy? Oh, it's a person called Natalie Jaresko. Who is Natalie? Natalie is a former U.S. State Department official. And she is now, and for several years, the CEO of a private equity firm called Horizon Capital. Yeah, Horizon Capital, that's been investing in Eastern Europe and the Ukraine now for several years. In other words, they put a U.S. citizen hedge fund shadow banker in charge of the Ukrainian economy. The key position of second key position of economics minister also went to another foreigner, a Lithuanian. I forgot his name here, but I did some research on him, and he's tied in with German hedge funds. So they got a Western Europe German financial shadow banker partly in charge, and they got a U.S. shadow banker in charge of the Ukrainian. Look, Poroshenko, Yatsenyuk, they're just puppets economically now. This whole economy is being run by the U.S. and Western Europe. They've taken it over. It's totally in their hands. They own the Ukraine now. And what are they going to do? Well, they're going to make sure they cut deals that enable their friends, Westerners, Western Europeans, and, of course, U.S. Investors, to cherry-pick the best of the businesses and resources in the Ukraine. They're going to steer all this money investment into the Ukraine, and they're going to direct it to their shadow bank and big capitalist investors friends. No doubt. You know, with the collapse of the economy and real business in Ukraine, there's going to have to be private bailouts. Well, these folks are going to help negotiate, you know, Natalie's going to help negotiate Western capitalists to buy up these Ukrainian businesses at fire sale prices, or buy into them 51% or whatever. They're going to pick up the best. And once they pick it up, these businesses, they're going to insist that they become more efficient. In other words, more mass layoffs. Right now, we got mass layoffs occurring in the Ukrainian and the government sector. You know, part of the IMF deal always is first, as I described, IMF comes in, we're going to give you a loan, okay, we're going to give you money. You're going to use so much of that money to pay back us and other bankers first. That's where the first priority goes. Second priority is, okay, what's left of the loan, we're going to give to your central bank so that they can finance exports from us in the West. Hmm? And then if you got anything left over, you can, central bank, you can use it to help prop up your currency if you need to. But that's where it all goes. Anything else that's spent on the real economy in the Ukraine, in these IMF deals, anywhere, has to come from squeezing the people, squeezing workers, squeezing other small businesses, you know, ending government spending on for example, in Ukraine, subsidies, gas subsidies. A big part of the Ukraine economy was because, you know, gas is so expensive and it's a cold country. People were subsidized. Their gas prices were subsidized by the government. Well, you know, they're going to eliminate those come January 1st, almost all of it. Well, that means everyone's going to pay more. And at the same time, the price of natural gas is going through, so through the roof. So you're not only not going to get subsidies, but you're going to pay more as well. At the same time, government jobs are being cut, wages are being cut, and pensions are being cut. So the real economy, the real people in the Ukraine are paying through the nose for this. And that's the cost of the IMF deal. In other words, we got to restructure and make business more efficient if, you know, you want our funding to continue, you know, because the IMF doesn't give $17 billion all at once. It only gave $4.5 billion, and it's got another $3 billion coming. And now the IMF and others are saying, look, you know, we want to see more cuts before we give you the other $3 billion. Hmm. And that's what's going on right now with the Ukraine. Ukraine is asking, pleading, Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk are pleading, more money, please, please, you know, help us, you IMF, you know, help us. And the IMF says, well, gee, I don't know. You know, we already gave $17 billion. We gave you another loan back in 2005. You still haven't paid off here. We're not so inclined. In other words, they're putting the screws to the Ukraine, even their puppet fellows there, Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk, they're putting the screws to them, and they're saying, cut some more. Cut more pensions. Cut more jobs. Cut more wages before we release the other $3 billion. And, you know, Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk, they're going hat in hand and they're saying, gee, you know, $17 billion isn't enough. We need more. And the IMF has even estimated that they'll need at least $15 billion more in 2015. Oh, $17 billion, another $15 billion, $32 billion, getting close to my $50 billion. And they're going to need more than that as well. But they're not going to, IMF, Europe, are not going to come up and give more until they see even more screws tightened. They'll keep the money flowing to pay their Western bankers and themselves. You know, that money never even leaves Western Europe and the IMF. It just goes from the IMF on behalf of a loan to the Ukraine, goes right to, you know, the banks in Austria and so forth. Okay. And what we have now is the G7, U.S., Europe, G7, Japan, Canada, they're the G7 countries, the big advanced economies of the West. And the G7 countries are saying, okay, you know, we may give you another $2 billion. The EU say, we may give you another $2 billion. That's so you can make your debt payments. in the next round starting in January. But if you want $15 billion more, you know, you got to turn the screws. Okay, the question is, will the Ukraine default on these IMF loans? Will they be able to? Well, I don't think they will, because the West will give them just enough to keep paying the principal and interest on what they own and keep pushing them to tighten the screws on the rest if they want to have any more money. Well, that's the situation in the Ukraine, right now. And it's going from bad to worse, going from the depression to severe depression, right? A recent item in the Financial Times of just a few days ago, December 18th, just to quote the conclusion of that article, says, quote, paying for Ukraine will be like West Germany paying for East Germany, except that Ukraine is bigger than East Germany, one European diplomat remarked. Who will pay will be an interesting talk. In other words, there's a summit coming up fairly soon between G7, Western Europe, and on the Ukraine itself, on the crisis in the Ukraine. Yes, that's serious. Right? If they do default, or if it appears they may default, no one knows what the impact is going to be on the financial markets. After all, you know, a default means what? It means banks in Europe and elsewhere aren't going to get paid. Oh, and if banks don't get paid, well, now you're starting a chain effect. So we have the shale oil gas default junk bond picture as a financial crisis center going on, a contagion possibility. We got the collapse of the ruble and banks in Russia and Europe and so forth as a contagion focus. And we have the Ukraine potential default as a contagion focus. By the way, I didn't even mention we may have the same situation in Venezuela. There's talk of default in Venezuela because of a very similar price crash, oil price crash, even more serious than in Russia going on. So the picture we have is a destabilizing global economy. Now, in the midst of all that, Japan announced last week, also last week, interesting week, you know, Japan announces its new Abenomics, Shinzo Abe, Prime Minister Abenomics, is called the austerity program in Japan. And we have the continued oil price collapse. We got the Ukraine situation. We got Russia's economy situation. We have slowing continuing in Europe. We have slowing continuing in China. And then, you know, we have this whippy effect in the U.S. of the central bank saying, oh, well, we'll keep the free money going, and the U.S. Investors go crazy. Happy. Big Christmas present. Right, for hedge funds and bankers and investors and the wealthy and all of those folks, you know, big Christmas present given to them by the Federal Reserve. And if you read the U.S. press, you know, everything looks, it's a great situation here. You know, the U.S. economy is recovering faster and so forth. You know, it's really a facade here. The U.S. economy is a Potemkin village, economic Potemkin village. You know, these were in the 19th century. If you traveled, Westerner traveled in Russia, they would set up these fake-looking storefronts and cottage fronts and so forth for Westerners that were traveling by train. They were called Potemkin villages. Behind it, there was this, you know, extreme poverty and decline. Well, the U.S. economy is a little bit of a Potemkin village right now. And I think as the global economy continues to slow, what we're going to see is, you know, some of those fake facades decline. But we'll have a show on that. We'll talk about that even more. Right now, you know, the top news of last week is includes this Abenomics 2.0. Now, I'm not going to have really enough time to treat the Abenomics 2.0, but it is an important development. You know, Japan second largest or third largest individual economy, about $6 trillion. Japan compares to about $9-10 trillion for Japan, for China, and the $17 trillion U.S. And if you put all of the Europeans together, it's about $13 trillion. Okay, so Japan is very important. Now, Japan, like the Federal Reserve, has pumped recently, in recent years, 2013, pumped huge amounts of money into the economy, its central bank. And the result was typical, a big boom in the stock market. But it all came to an end. And what happened this past spring, in the last 6 months, is Japan has fallen into another recession, its fourth in the last 6 years. So what we got is this new policy by Shinzo Abe, overlaid on top of his first policy, which is we call Abenomics 2.0, and it has the third arrow, the first two arrows of his first policy, where there's huge injection of free money by its central bank, plus raising a sales tax, and that threw the economy into recession here. So now we're going to see the third arrow, as it's called, Japan, and that's...